Good afternoon, everybody. This is Julie Fedorchak, a commissioner with the North Dakota Public Service Commission. It's Wednesday, October 21st, and we're gathered for a work session to discuss legislative issues and legislative policy and proposals. Our chairman, Commissioner Crotius, is participating by phone, and he's not here right now, so I'm going to run the meeting in his absence. Brian, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Excellent. Also here is Randy Christman, another commissioner, and we have our two attorneys and a number of staff. Is it possible to have the people who are participating electronically to identify themselves, Matt, or how would we do that? Since we invited a number of stakeholders and view this as an opportunity for stakeholder discussion, we would like to know who actually is participating. So where do we see this? The people underneath on the right. Nope. Wrong side. On the right-hand side, the people. Okay, so I can see some of you on GoToMeeting. All right, Jack, let's just run through. So here, I'm going to list who we know is here, and then there's a few folks who are not identified. So we've got Britta Andrud, Carly McCloy, Dan Litchfield, Jill Kringstead, Steve Call. Can you scroll down, Jack? And Patrick Fawn. So there's two people, caller one and caller two. If you could identify yourselves, that would be helpful if I didn't already list your name.
Commissioner Fedorchak, Kathy Oz, Xcel Energy.
Thank you, Kathy. One other mystery caller. Oh, maybe that is Brian. I bet it is. All right. I think it's Brian Crotius. All right. The mystery is solved. Okay, so we will have an opportunity. Jack, do you want to walk through things? Is that what we'd like to do? Or maybe we should, recognizing stakeholders' time, have the folks who are participating been privy to what we're looking at?
Sure. Commissioner Fedorchak, we did provide a copy or a form of the copy of the vast majority of the changes. Some of the edits didn't actually transfer from doc to PDF when I gave it to John Hamry to send out, as well as we would have hoped. But for the most part, I think most of the more concerning, probably substantive changes were all accurately reflected within what I provided.
And have you been in contact with most of the people?
I have tried to contact the vast majority of the people, and I think most people on this list here, to some degree, I've had some sort of discussions with. I know Carly actually discussed a number of these topics with you and I, Julie, in a previous meeting already.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if, and my colleagues can jump in here too if you have a desire for how we should run this, but I'm almost thinking we should go through the, because there's only one, two, three, four non-staff participants in terms of stakeholders, go through their issues, and then we can go back and go through everything so they don't have to sit through the entire discussion if they're not interested in certain pieces of our legislative proposals.
That's all right with me, although I expect they're going to want to stay around in case we come back and change something.
Sure, that's true.
I would understand that, but we can sure highlight those things.
If we get into the weights and measures discussion that we're anticipating, I wouldn't want to start with that, I guess is kind of where
I'm going. Nor the thing that was not sent out. In full disclosure, I'd said we were going to be bringing something with auctioneer licensing and auction clerk licensing. I don't know that any of these callers are particularly interested in that, so we could certainly hold that till last.
Sure. Okay. Then maybe we'll just go through. Oh, and I just got a text from Jessica Unruh. She's watching on the computer, but doesn't know how to tell us. So
we just found a way.
Text will do. Thank you, Senator Unruh. Let's see. Okay, so Jack, do you want to just dig in, or do you want to jump in at where you think people might be interested? I'm going to defer to you since you've had conversations with the
Matt,
stakeholders.
Can you come up here?
Sure. I think maybe it'd be good to start with the a couple of the more controversial topics, and if we did integrated resource plans and then the siting. I think then we could come back and hit up the other more minor topics.
Very good. Brian Draxton is also on the call from Otter Tail Power. Thank you, Brian.
All right, just
not sure how they'll speak. That's sure. The only problem here.
Yeah, we did not actually set up a bridge for people to call in, like the public. I did send out a go-to meeting to a number of people. If they email maybe Matt, he could add them into the go-to meeting.
With a direct- oh, there's Carly.
My apologies. This is Carly McLeod. I forwarded it to a variety of our utility people, and I just forwarded it again to Mark Bring, and I'm wondering if he'll share it with Brian Draxton so that... He can't be on the phone call, but he'll be through the meeting hopefully soon.
Very good. Thank you, Carly.
Right. Yep, you're welcome.
I apologize for those I've already spoken with, or the commissioners have already spoken with regarding a number of these topics. It might be a bit redundant with those conversations, but just because all parties weren't available there at that time or had an opportunity to speak, I'll just kind of dig into a number of these topics again. Starting off with 4905.04.3. Would be on your page 13 of the document that I sent out generally. One proposal the commission has is to add an integrated resource plan. As it currently stands, the commission already requires all the regulated utilities to provide an integrated resource plan. So from that standpoint, not much has changed unless additional regulations are provided in the manner and frequency that they need to be provided. But the big change that I think may see is in the event that the commission feels that further review of integrated resource plan is necessary, they would be able to request a fee of up to $175,000 in order to essentially investigate this and provide some sort of feedback or recommendations as it deems necessary. And understandably, we thought there may be some concerns, but so far we've actually had some pretty good responses to the integrated resource plan addition to our regulation.
Any feedback from those stakeholders who are participating on this proposal for the integrated resource plan? Or commissioners?
Go ahead. This is Brian Braxton with Otter Tail. I'd say generally we don't have a concern about filing a resource plan, but there are some unanswered questions, right? We do file them in Minnesota. It's set up to be every 2 years, and it's quite an undertaking to do one of those. And so I guess the thing that would be nice if somehow we could try to coordinate between states so that we could prepare one resource plan and file it in both jurisdictions. And then I think a second question is, would these resource plans be informational, or would they be for approval? And then if approved, what kind of weight would they carry in, say, rate case proceedings in the future? Are just some questions we have.
I'll go ahead and let Jack explain kind of where we're at with some of those things are already in place. So go ahead, Jack.
I guess, Brian, just to start off, I don't think the commission, at least as far as the conversations we've had so far, are looking to make this any more cumbersome than it really currently is. For the most part, at least on timing of filing integrated resource plans. Regarding what weight that this integrated resource plan and the decisions that the commission would be making on them, I think it varies to a degree. It wouldn't necessarily require a commission approval of this, but it would allow the commission to take action after investigation to provide some sort of record or recommendations or make some orders on resource selection. to the extent that they feel it's necessary to protect the public interest.
So currently, the public utilities submit integrated resource plans, so we already receive them. And they're usually the ones that are provided. Well, for Xcel and Otter Tail, they're Minnesota resource plans, aren't they, that we receive?
That's correct.
So we don't – this law wouldn't change that. It would just provide us the opportunity when we thought we needed it to request a filing fee of up to $175,000 to take a deeper look at what you've filed. Currently, we review them, but we don't have the staff time, nor have we had the ability to hire any outside staff because we haven't been able to charge a fee for that purpose, for a filing fee to help us review it. So this just allows us to assess a filing fee and hire additional consultants or use that fee to help us process the and review the integrated resource plan and take whatever action, whether it's just providing feedback to you or taking any sort of directive action as we deem necessary to assure that North Dakota is making its opinions on the desired resources to serve our customers so that's clear to the companies that we're regulating. So that's how I view it.
Anyway, this is Brian again, but I feel like as a utility, every time we file a resource plan in Minnesota, we not only file it with North Dakota, but we actually come out and walk through it with the commission. But, you know, sometimes it's an hour and a half long meeting or something, and you guys ask some questions. But, you know, I don't know that we walk out of there with a strong feeling about what you thought about the resource plan, if that was good, bad, if there's things you'd like to see different. And I think we would actually welcome the chance for us as a utility to get a little bit more concrete opinion from the commission on what they thought of our resource plan.
And this is Randy, and I'll say, you know, as we've reviewed resource plans, I've always felt almost overwhelmed, just like I would if you had a big rate case and we didn't have any tools to get outside help to help prepare for that, as well as our staff time being limited. And so we kind of just accepted them, and that was it, but didn't approve them. And I've always wished we could do more, but just acknowledged that we didn't have the resources. This would provide us the resources if we chose to. Now, we've talked about this a time or two before, and I didn't say anything. I want to point out this is new information that I've recently acquired. In fact, as recently as within the last few hours. But during the course of recent weeks or whatever, a week or 10 days, Wyoming took an initial action on a IRP review. That they did not actually take their final action on it yet, but released, I guess, some early assessment. I don't remember the term exactly for what they did with it, but the news is out there anyway. And in reviewing that, in the past, they have done with IRPs essentially what we did. They accepted them, but did not do a thorough review. In the IRP plan that they're working on now, they kind of benefited from a DOE study on the specific topic that provided a lot of information. And I think that cost them nothing. But we can't count on DOE doing a study of every IRP plan that gets filed here, like that case. But in addition to that, and this is what I only just recently learned, they also were able to hire a consultant for $300,000. Getting outside help, these are complex things, as I'm sure the companies know, that to prepare in the first place. They're also complex to thoroughly analyze. And so before, I had thought this just seemed like plenty of money until I found out what it took for Wyoming.
Are you proposing a change to this level?
It, I'm certainly not proposing to just accept this as it is. It's so new. I just need to contemplate that more. I hope to get some more information from that consultant mm-hmm. that did the work and just learn a little bit more about it. I don't want these numbers to become astronomical, but I also don't want to get into a position where we're actually issuing opinions on something that we haven't been able to thoroughly analyze. So I think it's something, in my mind, this is not a final number. It's a placeholder at this point.
That's good to note. I do think it's important also to note that no place in here does it require us to issue an opinion.
Right.
So that's not, like, we shouldn't ever be in a position where we have to take action or issue an opinion on something that we don't feel like we've had enough resources or time to review. I mean, better to say nothing than to say something wrong. that's half thought through. So,
and I'll highlight in that Wyoming case, it involved closure of multiple generation facilities and then replacements with others. Not every IRP is that dramatic either. So,
yeah,
that's a big hopeful difference.
I would even go a step further than that, Julie, and say that it actually doesn't even require us to do an investigation in the first place. If we're looking at the actions of a utility and we feel that there isn't really something that's flagging any concern, it may not even require an investigation in the first place. And on top of that, I guess if a company is looking to get some sort of recommendation from the commission, as it currently stands, we would not be able to provide that. So it really is an opportunity. We're reviewing it from the company standpoint and the companies that have an interest in having us do a review of an integrated resource plan and provide recommendations to be able to provide that service to the company as well.
Okay. Well, I think I would invite the stakeholders to think about what Commissioner Christman mentioned. And the language that we have right now says, at the request of the commission, the applicant shall file a fee reasonably necessary for completing an investigation of the integrated resource plan to the amount of $175,000. So, you know, because we're already acknowledging that it's reasonably necessary, so I'm assuming we will have to justify what we're requesting on the front end, not just say we need $175,000 and we'll give you back what we don't need. I would assume we'd still return what we don't use, but it sounds to me like we would be saying, here's what we would like to do, here's what it's going to cost. So, you know, if there's any circumstances by which that would be acceptable to have a higher amount, I think that would be helpful if our utility stakeholders would think about that question in lieu of what Commissioner Christman presented. All right. When do we actually have to have these wrapped up and submitted, Jack?
Well, they have to be submitted by December 4th.
Okay. So we still have about 6 weeks. Okay. Commissioner Crosius, do you have anything to offer on this issue or questions?
Nothing specific, more general in nature, and the question is, what are we going to do with it? Obviously, you know, if we're going to charge X amount and then turn around and spend X amount, both the company and I think, in fairness, the legislative body and just ratepayers will want to know what the actionable item is at the end of it, what the purpose, and I think that's something that I wrestled with in terms of, in the end, what's the deliverable? And the company wants direction. Ratepayers obviously want to know that we're taking another step into the process, going even deeper in terms of long-term planning. So I would echo, and essentially I am echoing what Commissioner Christman pointed out. I thought he did a very good job and laying out the same concerns that I would echo. So that's, I think, at this point, the questions that I have that can't be answered today, largely.
Okay. So Sounds good. Anything else from anybody on the integrated resource plan issue? Stakeholders? All right. Not hearing anything. Thank you for those who chimed in. Appreciate that feedback.
All right. I think I'm going to move on to the Electrical Siting Act 4922, and maybe I'll just walk all the way through all the changes regarding that, and then if we need to, we can come back and break down any of those specific subsections. Starting off with 492203, I'm sure as everyone recalls, the Siting Act was...
Jack, sure. For me to keep up, can you tell, I can't read the page numbers on the very bottom out of, you know, the out of 109, that one?
Sure.
Is it 24?
24.
No, that's the page number of the bill, isn't it?
Mm-mm.
No.
Okay.
I
can read that one.
Sure. Okay. So on page 24 is 4922.03, sub 3A1. And as everyone recalls, during the split of the Siting Act from electrical to hydrocarbon, there were just a couple of things that were left that need to be cleaned up, a couple misreferences. And, of course, we didn't think this would be controversial, but I just want to note that we were requesting that be changed. All right, moving down to page 33, should be 492207 for certificate of site compatibility or route permit required. And what this creates is what essentially substantively does is it requires an existing wind facility that is intending to repower the facility that does not previously have a site certificate to come in and obtain a site certificate from the commission. And we really think this is only going to impact, hypothetically, it could impact a few facilities, the ones that probably were constructed under the 100-megawatt siting threshold or the 50 or 61 that existed for a period of time before it was ultimately moved down to the half a megawatt. And we also provide an additional provision in there that upon a good showing of good cause and approval of the local zoning authorities, a variance may be granted for any of the setback encroachments caused by a larger hub and blade lengths. It's worth noting that this is set at an existing facility that already exceeds, that's going to exist, that exceeds 5 megawatts. There was some discussion within the commission that we move that up to 10 megawatts or even up to 20 megawatts, and so I would be interested in hearing the industry's take on that. And we're also considering some other language allowing your variances from setback encroachments caused by repowering if approved by the local zoning authorities and if good cause is shown. And that just creates a broader language on the ability to provide variances and it doesn't subject it solely to a larger hub or blade length. All right, moving on to 49.
Hold on. Are you going to go through everything and then come back for questions? Or
I was going to do that, but we could stop at any point in time if you'd like.
How many are there, Jack?
On this Siting Act, there's, after this, and there's 1, 2, 7.
Yeah, I don't know. It might just be easier so we don't have to refresh.
Sure.
Just go through if there's issues on and some of them there's not much. So
right.
I think it might be easier to just take comments on the pieces because they're all pretty unrelated.
Sure.
So anybody on the call, any stakeholders have some feedback on this proposed change? I did get a text from Levi Andrist, and he's listening. This might be one that the wind group would have input on, but he's not. I don't think he's able to talk, so maybe they don't. Have you talked to him directly about this?
I did briefly speak with Levi, and I think he didn't provide any sort of concerns.
Okay. All right, well, not seeing any feedback on this, so.
Sure. Well, if any of you do have feedback on language changes on this, I would appreciate that. Or if you feel that the megawatt level should be moved up from 5 to 10 or something like that, I would also really welcome some comments on that as we're working on this.
With hopefully a reason why, other than like, well, it'd be handier.
Right.
Exclude me.
All right, moving on to 4922.7.2. This is the waiver procedures and time schedules, and you'll find this on page 33. So the amendments, this it really makes it clear that the commission may waive procedures and time schedules without a hearing if either a demonstrable emergency exists or there are minimal adverse impacts shown. It may be worth noting that it provides a little more flexibility in the commission determining what a demonstrable emergency is before it defined it a little more narrowly. And then to a degree, this conflicts with some later language, 4922.13.2. That provides that the commission may not be required to hold a hearing and may instead issue a notice of opportunity. What we've run into with a number of companies is they'll have a minor alteration that technically requires them to require a public hearing, and their concern is that they want to make sure they're doing everything right. And quite honestly, when we review it, it's such a minor change that it hardly deserves a public hearing. They've already done a lot of the legwork, or it also already exists within some current brownfield site. And this would allow us essentially to be more flexible with not being required to hold certain hearings and waiving certain procedures, and possibly streamline the process and making it cheaper for the companies, as well as making it simpler for us to administer.
Any issues with this one? Okay. Yep.
Moving on to 4922.13, which is on page 42. So this makes it clear that the commission may hold a remote public hearing if it determines that emergency exists, and it also provides that there are no adequate facilities to conduct a public hearing within the county in which any portion of the site or route is proposed, that we actually may just move it to the nearest adequate location. And as you guys probably have noticed with the current change in the current process, is that we found that there may be times where we need to hold remote hearings in order to continue doing business within the state. And this is to accommodate those changes and to provide the commission flexibility to address them.
And is there a definition of emergency anyplace, Jack?
It isn't defined as it is written. It is intended to provide flexibility to the commission in determining the various forms of emergencies that may come up and act accordingly with them.
Okay.
And I'm just going to weigh in here on this because I think I like the legislative change. I hope that we continue to have as many of these hearings as is reasonably possible, as we did before, out in those areas. I think it's important to have them in those areas when possible. But I do like this, that we don't have to rely on the governor's executive order, that we can declare some other level of emergency if we felt it's necessary. And also in those situations, we've got a handful of counties, especially if something was expected to be a pretty big hearing, where sometimes the next county over has a much better facility. And in the case of one project that we had that I can recall was actually closer to the project anyway.
Yeah.
So I like this bill, but I just want to emphasize, in my opinion, I hope that we will continue to have these. It's not my goal to move all these to the Capitol.
Yep, I think that's important. Will be important to emphasize in the legislature too, because that clearly wasn't the intent of the siting law.
Yeah.
So, all right. Any feedback on this change from stakeholders? Sweet. Thanks, Jack.
You're welcome. All right, moving on to light mitigation technology. I assume there'd be some interest in this one, and Brian and I already had some discussions with Levi and with Wind and Carly regarding some legislation that the commission may have some interest in proposing that would essentially allow, after a public hearing, that the commission may grant a waiver or extension of time based upon technical or economic feasibility considerations for not just the facilities that were cited prior to, I think it was the July,
was June it June 5th,
June 5th date, but all wind facilities that have a site certificate.
What page is this?
This would be page
49.
And as the commissioners recall, we previously had some drafted legislation, and Brian had that. But after some discussions with the industry, we dialed it back to based upon some of the concerns that were expressed, and we believe that this will substantively still address the impacts that we were looking at and still accommodate what the industry was looking for.
And the public hearing, can you talk about that a bit? Is this the second public hearing after the siting hearing, or will the siting hearing effectively be the public hearing that is envisioned here?
Sure. It could go along with a siting hearing if the commission would choose to do so. It could be a separate hearing as well. It provides flexibility in doing it either way. But if we would do it as part of the siting hearing, we would probably have to notice it as an issue. That would be the small change.
So in order to do that, the company would have to know at the time of the hearing that for whatever reason they can't do this immediately or ever, perhaps, and tell us that so that it can be listed as a specific issue at the hearing in order to meet the requirements of this.
Correct.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Otherwise, we'd have to have a separate subsequent hearing.
Okay.
Maybe you said this, and I was making some notes in the previous legislation, but we currently could do this on the ones that were built earlier, but we don't have the option of an extension or waiver on the ones since the requirement was put into place. Am I correct?
For facilities that were cited prior to June 5th, 2016, we were allowed to provide an extension for the implementation.
Okay.
It doesn't have any waiver language. Facilities cited after, there was neither option provided.
Okay. Any feedback on this one from stakeholders?
Commissioner, this is Carly from the Utility Shareholders. I just wanted to thank Brian and Jack for the time they spent with us before talking through our concerns on this. And we feel that this language mirrors what was discussed as the bill was working its way through conference committees, but the language didn't reflect that. So we're comfortable with it at this point.
Thanks, Carly. This feels a little cleaner to me than what some of the earlier proposals were. How does it fit with our rules?
As
it would
subsequent to this, after this legislation, if it is enacted, we would still have to promulgate some rules to accommodate the changes.
Yep.
But in the meantime, the authority to provide a waiver and extension already exists within the statute.
And it's the same language that exists for the facilities that were being retroactively required to put the light mitigating stuff on.
Well, currently it only the older facilities only we can provide an extension. This now allows us to provide a waiver and extension. It does mirror that for the new facilities.
Okay. All right. I think it's, yeah, I'm good with it. Brian, you have any additional thoughts on this one, or Randy?
I do not at this point.
Okay.
I do not.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for your work on that. That might save months of work in the legislature.
Moving on to...
Maybe. Maybe not.
Moving on to 49-22-22 sub 1D. This has to do with citing process expense recovery.
What page again?
This was on page 53 is where it starts. And there's just a minor clarification. As it currently stands within the law, for any sort of publication or notice that the commission issues, the applicant is required to pay for it. That's in a separate section of law, and so there was a little bit of confusion, and I believe the public utilities director wanted to provide just a little clarification to ensure that when people are looking through the Siting Act, they know that they're required to pay for that notice, you know, under the Siting Act as well as the broader commission authority. Moving down to sub G, this provides in the event that the application fee is less than $25,000, an applicant may agree to provide additional fees that are reasonably necessary for the completion of the site corridor or route evaluation and designation process. And just to give a little background on this, the circumstances that allowed us to consider this amendment was we've had a number of applications that have come in and they've been bottoming out at that $10,000 minimum fee. However, to hold the hearing and publish them and get consultants to evaluate the site and the impacts from the construction, at times it has gotten very close or was above the $10,000 fee that was provided. Now, if in the event that the commission did want to actually request and receive additional fees from a company, what we run into is a situation where we can't accept it unless we go to the emergency commission. What this provides is in that event, in that circumstance, that the company can agree to pay the additional fee up to $25,000. And that's essentially what we assume to be enough to do any sort of the processing, getting a consultant for the construction inspections and the publication and our creating our electronic record without having to go to the emergency commission, which would be beneficial from us because then we wouldn't have to go to the emergency commission. And we felt it would be beneficial to the industry as well because it would prevent them from having to wait for us to go to the emergency commission that only periodically meets.
The key words being may agree.
May agree.
That so the company would be able to say, yeah, this makes sense. Let's do it.
Correct.
Jack, am I right that where this kind of frequently occurs is projects, especially pipelines, that transition from a distribution line to a transmission line and thus needs a siting approval, but it's already in the ground, so there's not really construction costs, so the filing fee is minimal, but it could still be a substantial project that we have to have a siting case for, and the numbers currently being spent just don't give us enough fee, right?
That's a really good example of the type of projects that have brought this about.
Anything else, Randy?
No.
Okay. Do any stakeholders have concerns about this? I see Danette on the phone or on the web. So she's of the pipeline nature.
Well, actually, Commissioner, this is Danette, and I did have a question on that. I didn't know if you wanted me to wait until you get down to the section that deals with pipelines specifically, or if you just want me to ask it now since it's the same in both sections.
Go. I think you should go ahead and ask it now. Thanks, Danette.
You bet. So my question is, what happens if a company doesn't agree to pay the additional fees. That was a question our legal counsel had brought forward as a concern.
Sure. It would proceed just as it normally does right now. As it currently stands, if they did not choose to pay for the additional fees, the options are either we have to go to the emergency commission to get the additional fees, and then at that point in time, with the approval of the emergency commission, we could assess the additional amounts. Or in the alternative, there have been times where when it's been such a minor amount, the commission has I think they've, in a few instances, the commission has just ate the costs to a degree, but it's always been a very minor amount.
Okay. The other question that they had brought forward on this section was about the $25,000 threshold, wondering if that was something that needed to be changed in the law, or if it was a rule issue, and how the minimum amount is. I guess, how you calculate getting to the minimum amount?
I know that's something that we discussed as well. I think the commission would be agreeable to increasing the minimum amount to $25,000. However, we do note that sometimes it only costs $10,000 for some of these very small projects. In those cases, it isn't much of a concern. So we really just felt that if we put the ball in the industry's court to essentially pay the additional amounts, which we felt was a benefit to them, rather than wait for us to go to the emergency commission, that they would have an interest in doing that.
Those are all good answers for me. And what I'll tell you right now is I don't know if we've ever had a project that wasn't much higher. So I don't think we've ever had anything that was at a minimum amount, but those were the questions that our legal counsel had thought to ask.
Sure.
So thank you for that.
Welcome.
Okay. Anybody else? Questions about this one?
And as we're proceeding through these, are there any from the hydrocarbon side and the pipeline side? And if you have any thoughts on this, feel free to chime in, because for the most part, as you guys have probably noticed, that they really mirror each other. So if we could only go through this once, that would actually be preferable.
Yeah.
So feel free to jump in if you do have any concerns as we go through it.
So Dale or others on the electric side, if you have concerns about this, this would apply to you guys too. Zach.
All right, moving on to page 55, 49, 22, 25. This was something that the commission has been considering for at least a the more recent months, and what we really wanted to clarify is that we have the authority to approve temporary operations or variances for certain facilities. I know during the most recent downturn, there were some facilities that were looking to operate not in compliance with their site certificate or route permit, but didn't want to wait through the more cumbersome amendment process that requires a notice of opportunity and so forth. And what this just does is for more of a temporary variance from those operations, it allows the commission to, without a hearing, approve those short-term variances upon a showing of good cause and, as it currently is written, receipt of certain certifications that will have no adverse impacts. They'll comply with all the current conditions of the law, and that they do some legwork to make sure their response plans and the landowners are notified. And so we thought this is it provides additional flexibility to really address concerns in the industry. And another situation we've kind of run into recently was with a transition from a gathering to a transmission line for facilities. After they realized that they have to get a site certificate, either the option now is to operate out of compliance with the law. However, this would provide them an opportunity instead to receive an approval for temporary operation of facilities while we're waiting for the more permanent siting process to be conducted.
So anytime I see whole paragraphs of changes, I get nervous, but it all makes sense. And it's similar language that's reflected from other parts of the law, so it's not really new. So anybody have concerns, questions, or want to say they like this idea and flexibility? I'm sure there will be those who step forward and say they don't like it, so during the session.
There's one item that Commissioner Fedorchak discussed in a previous legislative discussion was to take away the multiple subsections of the utility certification and instead leave it a little more open and instead just require a showing of good cause. And I'd be interested if that's something that the industry would be interested in having an amendment or a minor change to the proposed legislation.
Repeat.
Rather than all of those A, B, C, D, or what do you mean, Jack?
Right, so we have all the subsections of requirements for that the utility has to certify prior to receiving a temporary operation or variance. And Commissioner Fedorchak in our previous discussion said, why don't we just make them show good cause? And if we need to, we can look into these things, but it wouldn't require them to necessarily do those additional steps on the front end.
Yeah, so the question is it helpful to be clear about what we're going to use to determine good cause and have it included in the law or just have it be more concise in the law?
That's right.
Is there a preference out there?
It's a lot easier to fix these bills now than to amend.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And if you want to look at it and think about it and let us know, that's fine too. We still have time. Might be the first time some people are looking at it. So, all right. Yes, thanks, Danette.
Yeah, I just wanted to offer that our legal counsel has been kind of going back and forth on that very same question about whether or not good cause is definable or if it really makes the section more subject to challenge, if you will. So we're still considering kind of what we think about that, but at this point, we like the idea. We just know that the devil's always in the details.
Right. Sure. Good. I'm glad to know you're thinking about it and talking about it with your folks. And any others in the pipeline industry would be helpful to get their feedback and read as well and try to iron out the best possible language prior to the session. So,
I would note that this also is this is the Electric Siting Act that we're viewing right now.
Oh, it is.
So it also applies to them as well.
Okay. Very good.
All right, moving down to 49-22-26. And if any of you are familiar with SHPO's laws for protecting cultural and historic sites, this is pretty similar to what they have, except for that is at the direction of their director. What we have is a situation where sometimes we're receiving third-party information, but they've been working with SHPO. But the manner which is provided to us is whether we can protect it is a little bit questionable. And so what we really were just looking for is a black and white. This is clear that this is information that we could protect, and we don't have to beat around the bush or do some unique and rare or interesting filings in order to ensure that we can protect the information.
That seems straightforward enough.
And I did discuss that with SHPO too, and
I'm
not a couple members, and they're pretty agreeable to it.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Jack.
Welcome. All right, now hopping over to the hydrocarbon side, I probably won't run through all of them because almost all of them are the same. There's one minor difference, and that's on the electric safety side. Again, another remnant of the splitting of the Siting Act to electric and hydrocarbon. Under this section, it says that the electric generation, it essentially is subject to the National Electric Safety Code. This would have been under the wrong chapter. And so we just removed it from this, and probably what would be appropriate is we actually move this over to 4922.
Okay. Is that up here right now?
Yep, it's right here. For 922.1-23.
I see. I was looking at the historical site stuff. All right. Thanks, Jack.
On page 89, every other change is reflected within the Electrical Siting Act as it currently is written.
All right. So just making sure nobody has any from the gas or electric side, any other offers of input on these issues for today's discussion?
I want to, when they're...
Go ahead, Randy. I don't think anyone's...
I want to throw one thing out on these because I've never been clear on it or I guess never given it much thought. Are we planning one great big siting bill with all these changes or to divide these out? Because I really fear that, you know, there could be a lot of good ideas that us and the companies and the public agree on that could get derailed over one thing that ends up being controversial, and then somebody just gets mad and kills the bill. And so I don't know that we want all of this, you know, both hydrocarbons and electric and all these completely different changes all in one bill.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got the most experience with legislative strategery. So
almost everything has a counter side to it. You know, there's positives and negatives to dividing it up, I guess. It's a lot more work for us, a lot more work for them, yeah. A lot more work for the utilities to keep coming to these various hearings. So I don't think we want to get carried away mm-hmm. with it, but I do think this needs to be divided into a few bills.
Well, I would agree, and some of this stuff I think even might be better brought forward by industry in some cases. So perhaps the wind stuff when it relates to the waiver for the ADLS, that I think might be better coming from industry with our support, obviously, but some of the other maybe like the application fees and that sort of thing, that seems more like an us deal. But perhaps this additional flexibility that we're looking at in the pipeline and electric side might be something that the industry wants to talk about bringing forward as well.
Yeah, I sure would not feel bad if industry chose to take some of these and run. It would be nice if they would tell us so we would know then that we don't need to
right.
be working on them. But that would be nice. I'm thinking just as a thought a little more. For instance, the first thing we talked about, it, the integrated resource plans, I can see a lot of discussion on that. That might be its own bill.
Yeah. And that's
I guess that's not in siting anyway.
Yeah.
Even within this siting, I think I would find some examples that I think should be separated from some others.
I think that's a good point. And maybe it warrants us kind of looking at what would be some natural divisions and then talking to the industry to see if anybody wants, if they want to present it, and then going from there with our own bills after that.
Commissioner, this is Carly.
Thanks, Carly.
All right, my dogs are also joining in on the call. from my standpoint, there's nothing in this package that we would rather industry run with than the PSC. We'd be happy for you. I'm not Maisie, no. We'd be happy for you all to take it. Maisie is enthusiastically supportive of you supporting all of these bills. I'm going to mute her now.
Remind me never to allow Maisie to be opposed to any of my ideas. Quite outspoken.
I'm not trying to be opposed to you. I'm just saying from my industry standpoint, we're happy to have you take these.
Okay. Very good.
Well, as I look back through the Siting Act as it originally was written and as it's been going or moving forward, it was a very structured and slow process, and as we're moving forward, I really noticed that the industry as well as the regulatory tools that we need to accommodate the concerns of the industry. There needs to be more flexibility, and really that's what we're trying to do. Heavily, this was based upon concerns expressed through the siting of the hydrocarbon side, but we really wanted that opportunity to be for the electrical side as well. So if you do have any input on that, and like Julie and Randy and Brian, who is on the phone, as previously stated, I'd be really happy to receive any input or minor alterations or concerns from you as we work to confirm and finalize a lot of this.
Thanks, Jack.
Welcome. Moving down to another thing Carly may have some thoughts on is the one-call law. This is on page 108. And this is 49-2306. And there's just a little addition, and I apologize when we transferred it to PDF. This didn't show up as underlined in your copies. But the change is if the damage results in the escape of any flammable, toxic, or corrosive gas or liquid, the excavator shall immediately contact appropriate authorities by calling the 911 emergency telephone number to report the damage. And this was a result of some of our more recent PHMSA audits where they expressed concern that that isn't a requirement within our current statute. So in order to ensure that we receive good audits from PHMSA and we're appropriately conducting our business in their viewpoint, this is a proposal that we were planning on bringing forward.
Yeah, this is Carly. Since you mentioned my name, I fully support this. I know you talked about it in the past, and I supported it then. So I'm going to mute again because all three of my dogs want to join in again.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Hi, this is Brian. Jeanette, are you still on? Do you have any thoughts on this? You've been really close to the one call law.
Yeah, thank you. Actually, this is not uncommon practice in many of the other states where we operate, so I don't know that we would have any concerns with this being added in.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for asking, and I do need to drop off for another meeting, so if there's anything else that I can help with or anything I can do, just let me know. Thank you.
Thanks, Danette.
All right, well, I'll just hop up to the top. There are a couple of minor changes that we were planning on proposing, just a little bit of cleanup, and we didn't really think this would be overly controversial. In the mining reclamation section, I think this starts from the beginning on page 1, 38-14.1-19. If anybody has gone through the application renewal process for mine permitting, I'm sure you've realize when there is an objection or someone is requesting some sort of procedural hearing or informal conference that the working with the commission at time there's a real time crunch to actually functionally hold these informal conferences. And so we instead recommended and we're planning on providing an amendment changing the requirement to schedule an informal conference within 30 days of receipt of a request and moving it out to 45 days. And this is something we've run by OSM and they were on board with. Moving down to 38-14.1-22.
Page.
I don't see it underlined here, but I should be able to find it pretty quick. It'll be on page 3. And this must have had a problem with the translation of this. It's on the sub 3. The application for permit renewal must be made at least 120 days prior to the expiration of the valid permit. That's as it's currently written. What we plan to do is just move it out a little bit longer to 180 days. And again, this is something we ran by OSM, and they were comfortable with. We didn't hear back any concerns from the industry this far, but if there are some concerns, we'd be interested in hearing your take on that. There was one additional change that we proposed, and we ran by OSM as well, and that would have allowed us more time to schedule a formal hearing as well, but they stated that they would not be agreeable to that, and ultimately we need their approval to make these legislative changes.
Didn't somebody from the mines express some concern about one of these, and I think it was the 120 days to 180, and felt that that was a little too much?
As far as I've heard from Dean and his discussions with the different mines, he did not believe there were any concerns, but if there are, it'd be good to know.
Well, Senator Unruh, if you're still on board, I guess I'm unclear on that, whether there were any objections to either of these, so we'll keep our ears open.
Okay.
And the final one, which is on page 4, this is regarding the testing of gas and electric meters. As the commission currently administers this section, we don't currently have the ability to do the testing. We don't have the actual equipment to do it at this point. I know previously in past history we did. Based upon our current regulations, the company does test their meters, and they provide us status reports on them. And we've always retained that authority to be able to go out and test them ourselves, as well as probably retain someone to a third-party tester to help us out with it as well. But as it currently is written, it says the commission, we have the duty to make the test, and we would just like to make it clear that the manner in which we are doing and administering this, our public utility division, we still retain that opportunity, but for the most part, we're requesting it from the companies.
Okay. My only concern with this is that the May makes it sound like we may not do it, and I think that would legitimately raise some concerns if any consumers read it that way.
Sure.
Because I think they want to make sure the meters are accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, the truth is we do get these tests and we receive them every year and we look at them. I actually look at them myself. And I'm sure my colleagues do as well. So, and we've talked about the May. Why did we settle back on May and not just say shall test, request a public utility test, or you use a third party test?
Sure.
So that it's still clear that this is something that we have to do. And
well, as it was previously written with shall, it provided an affirmative duty for us to do this, and as it currently is written, we're trying to create that permissive authority of the three ways we may do it and essentially accomplish this.
If someone would may not do it too, if you add may.
That's correct. We would, that also would be arguably we may not do it as well. But in order to actually do that, if anyone did have any questions regarding this, if they just looked at our regulations, it's abundantly clear that these are being tested. And if we did have the affirmative duty to do it, we would actually have to actively go out and do these things.
Even if you say may test, request a public utility test, or use a third-party test, add that language in, but keep the shall?
Sure. I suppose we...
Seems to me the or would give us the option.
Yeah, that's what I'm struggling with.
I'm not a language expert.
Sure. When we went through and wrote this, we were really writing it from the manner in which we may be permitted to do the testing. If we did actually change it to shall, I don't think that really would be a major cause for concern. We changed it from shall previously due to the fact that we shall test it. So this was probably our third rendition of this draft.
Yeah.
After our multiple discussions. And in the past legislative discussion, when we all sat down and discussed the regulations, this is where the commission ultimately ended up.
I must have misspoke then, because I always assumed we would keep the shall and add the other options for how we are currently making, performing that duty.
Sure.
Well, so I guess I would prefer to keep the shall and just add the other things in there so that it's clear that we don't have to do the testing ourselves, but that it's still our obligation to make sure it's done.
Sure. Well,
as long as there's not some grammatical reason that that throws it off. As long as we can use shall, but it leaves us these to choose one of these three options,
mm-hmm.
for shall as well.
Well, from looking at it right now, I think that would probably work. I know Brian had worked on this section specifically. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, because we did have some discussion of why we ended up or how we ended up in this point.
I think we could go back to shall. I don't think that causes any concerns. I'm not sure if I'm remembering this correctly, but I don't remember if we talked about staffing concerns and responsibility on who's going to be doing this and taking care of it all. Going back to shall doesn't. It's still then we're required to do this,
which we already are doing.
Well,
I mean, we're getting the third party or the utilities tests.
Well, they're providing it to us because they're required to, but we're not doing it.
We're not doing the tests ourselves, no.
Right.
But we're requesting them and analyzing the data that we receive from the utilities on the tests.
I assume so, yes.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, we're kind of, right now, I think we're doing what this says.
Yes.
But what this says if we pass this change. Mm-hmm. But if we really, I think, went by the letter of the law, it doesn't give us the option to have them get someone to test it. It requires
right.
us to have some people to go out and do all these tests.
Sure.
Right.
And I guess from staff standpoint, just to kind of bring this around, usually when we're doing this drafting, we always draft it as much more as a permissive statement. It provides us more flexibility in not only how we administer a program or make changes or alterations as we do in as needed in regulation.
And I know it's a small thing, and I hate to admit to anybody that we spent 5 minutes talking about
yeah.
the difference between may or shall, but as it relates to this thing, I think it's important for the public, and there are some policy folks out there that pay attention to these types of words, don't get the impression that we now want to back away from any requirements that we have to make sure that the meters that are being used to charge them for their electricity are not being, we have the option of not testing them anymore. I just don't think that's the message, a good message to send.
I guess the way I look at it is, since we're being provided the data anyway, this allows us the permissive chance to, if we get something that we don't like or see something we don't like or get consumer complaints, then we could then spend the time to go in and test it and do it and not be just doing it all the time, even though we're already getting the information, I guess is the way I look at it and kind of the reason why I went from shall to may. And the shall to may is actually a pretty important conversation to have in these laws. It really does. It's very important. It's
yep.
not. It's small but mighty, I guess I would say, in because it alters the meaning and the duties that we're required to do. So
agreed. I just think it's better to keep it at shall and add what the other options are.
If I was still down there voting on these things, and was wearing my skeptical hat, I'd say, we might not always have these same commissioners or commission staff. We put this into law. That gives a future commission the option of not doing any of these.
Right.
And I'm not going to vote for that. And so I just think if it's May, this is likely not to pass.
True. Well, I wouldn't mind looking back to see how the term shall, because as we're doing it, we are requesting a public utility test, how that may be read in light of our current administrative rules, because that could fundamentally alter our current regulations. I would like to double check to make sure that we would be in compliance completely with that duty.
If we put shall in?
Right.
But isn't that how it reads today?
Shall request.
So how could it?
Sure. How we are currently doing this, I guess, if there is that affirmative duty, is the commission shall request a public utility test, which is what we are doing. To essentially meet that affirmative duty as of today.
So right now it says the commission shall test
right.
meters used.
Yes, and we are not testing the meters used. So what we are doing is we are having the public utility test the meters, and we're reviewing what we receive. So if we shall require them to request the meters, then I just want to make sure our current regulations do meet that affirmative duty. They probably do, but since we were writing this in a permissive manner, that allows us a lot more flexibility. I'll probably just have to come back through and make sure that does it. They are met in our current regulations and current practices by the utilities.
All right. It seems like it would be hard to that they wouldn't be if we're keeping the shell and that's what it was. But whatever. Whatever you have to do. I don't know where Brian is on this issue, if he's got thoughts on the shell versus may test, request a public utility test or use a third party to test meters used. But it sounds like Randy and I both prefer shall versus may.
Sure. Well, I believe that's probably going to be fine. I just would like to, like I said, double check it in light of both the gas and the electric side. I looked at the electric side pretty extensively, and I glanced at the gas, and they aren't exactly the same with how the testing is done. And so
I'd like to do a double review of that.
Sounds good.
All right. I'm surprised that was the longest discussion. that one was the we didn't need to discuss it all item, but I guess if there are any other comments from anybody, I wouldn't mind hearing them on any of the proposed changes or amendments.
This is Carly. Since my dogs haven't barked for a while, I was going to say this is why you need English majors and attorneys on these conversations.
That's right. All right. Looks like all's quiet on the phone slash, what are we on? GoToMeeting front. So, thanks, everybody, for participating. It's not as easier, probably as productive as being in person, but it is the best we could do under the circumstances. Randy, you have something else to say?
Yep, I don't want to mislead them into thinking that we're concluding, because I would like to talk about auctions just a little bit.
Right, that's right.
But if they're not interested, they can leave. I think if I'll wait with this until we're sure we're done with these other subjects.
So that concludes our discussion about our existing legislative proposals. And then we're going to move into a discussion about auctioneer potential changes to that language, but it's related to their training. Is that what it is? No?
It's a variety of things with auction and auction clerk licenses.
Okay. All right. So we'll move into that discussion now. So only those interested in auctioneer licensing requirements need stay on the line. Everybody is, of course, welcome to stay on the line, and I do not anticipate us going back and talking about any of the issues we've already discussed. So just to assure you of that, those issues are put to bed. We will set up another probably final discussion about legislative changes before Thanksgiving.
And do you think that'll probably be internal or also still allowing for industry participation?
I think it would be best if industry gave us their feedback, you know, directly between now and then. But I'm always open to open discussion, especially when it comes to this stuff, because quite honestly, it's talk about it now or get to the hearing, and then everybody's talking about it in front of the hearing. So,
okay.
Even once we submit something, if someone has a good new idea, we come and bring amendments. But it would sure help if they would get us their thoughts before we meet again, because if they wait till that day, then we're back to needing to meet again to review the changes that they suggest. So.
All right.
Commissioner Christman, I do want to note that I do have to sneak out here. I have another appointment that I have to head to, but I've spoken pretty extensively with Conrad, I believe, on most of these issues, and so I think if there's anything I have to provide, he probably already knows it.
Yeah. And when we get a feel for what people like, we'll get more detail. Okay. There's nothing written here, just my comment.
Okay, good. Thanks. Thank you, Jack. Thanks, everybody, for your
really good work
input today.
So we've talked from time to time about auctioneer and auction clerk stuff, and And I invite Conrad to flail away or grab a mic or whatever he wants
Maybe
to do
Conrad,
if I
can come sit over here.
Misspeak. But we've talked about a lot of potential changes, and I'm even flipping back and forth, so I'm not coming at all these things as like really adamant that this is what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So we have separate bond requirement for auctioneers as opposed to auction clerks. Auctioneers is $5,000, auction clerks is $10,000. And I don't know if I kept that note, but we have more than twice, we have about 325 auctioneers licensed and about 136 clerks. So it's far more auctioneers than clerks.
What do the clerks do?
The clerks are responsible for handling the funds at the auction sale. That's their primary role. They do some other ancillary duties, issue bidding numbers, get people signed up to register to bid. But ultimately, when someone's coming to pay for items, they're going to pay directly to the clerk. And so our laws are set up that the auctioneer is going to conduct and hold the sale, but it's the clerk that's going to be handling the funds in the closing statement.
Okay, good.
And for example, the clerks have a certain, I would call it a fiduciary responsibility. For example, one of the requirements of clerks is they have to have a separate bank account for their clerking from their personal things. You know, you don't go to the auction sale and collect a $500,000 or $1 million and stick it in your own account and then drag your feet or, you know, be incentivized. It's separate accounting. And so there's some important functions there.
What was the difference in their bond requirements again?
$10,000 on clerks, $5,000 on auctioneers. So Conrad researched other states, about half of which do some kind of licensing in the first place. A lot of states don't have any, or sometimes a city or a county might have licensing authority, but not the state. But roughly half the states do something. I'm really concerned, especially with the auction bonds. I don't see a lot of circumstances where we would be able to collect anyway, and I think it, when they say that they're bonded by the State Public Service Commission, I think it leads people to believe everything is covered here, like we found out in grain licensing mm-hmm. one time. And no state has more than, I think, $25,000, as I recall, which to me is also woefully inadequate. A lot of these are part-time people. I don't want to create such a unique and high bond that it covers these. I mean, a lot of these sales are millions of dollars.
Mm.
I really think we would be better off, actually, not requiring bonds on auctioneers, but to elevate them some on the auction clerks. I'm trying to get information what it would cost to elevate them on the auction clerks. One person was going to check into it for me and told me that he thought that like going up to $25,000 or $30,000 probably wouldn't cost any more. That would probably fall under a minimum. This is so low.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have that information yet. So that's two changes we're looking at, is just eliminating the bonding requirement on those 325 auctioneers, but elevating the requirement on the clerks. But the second big change would be to...
But one more question on that. Elevate it to $25,000?
I'd like to wait something like that. I was hoping for maybe even around 50 or something. I'd like to wait until we see once what it's going to cost them to do that.
Okay, so if it's like a range, like...
I'm thinking in that $25,000 to $50,000 range. And I will also point out, aside from our licensing, not registered, but banks and credit unions, I imagine, are able to provide clerking service without this anyway, because it's, you know, just kind of part of their other what they
sure.
do.
So they can send somebody out as a clerk?
Yes.
Oh.
Correct. And there's no bond required if it's a financial institution.
Sure.
And just to put some historical perspective on, the last time clerk bonds were increased was 1983. They increased them from $5,000 to $10,000. Mm. And just before this, Commissioner Christman, I did kind of a quick Google search to see, I don't know, you know, this is rough numbers, but $10,000 in 1983 in today's money basically would be about $23,000 to $26,000 at that time. So that's kind of the, with inflation, how that would equate to what that money would be valued in 1983.
And the, do we know how many of the auctions that are held use a bank versus a clerk?
We have no way of knowing that. A number as far as how many. I mean, the best we could probably do is reach out to the 15 or so firms that we have licensed as clerks, the financial institutions, just say, how often do you offer clerking services, and just see what we get back. But we don't have any records to track that.
Are the banks licensed with us still?
Yes, they still have to have they still have to carry a license with us.
Oh.
They just do not have to carry a bond.
I see. Okay. And how many of the, how many clerks do we have total, and how many of them are banks?
We've got approximately 136 clerks, and then the banks would be looking at about 15.
Okay.
And so it's not out of the 136 as a separate number.
Oh, okay. Got it. Thank you. All right, sorry, Randy.
So I think the increase in clerk bonds is, I think, a given. I certainly want to proceed with that. I think the bigger question is, should we just get rid of those bonds on the auctioneers? And right now I'm leaning that way. But I'll be curious your thoughts. You can visit with Conrad if you like to. But one of the things, and darn it, I was going to bring the language and didn't. What is the term for, you know, the upstanding citizen kind of requirement of auctioneers?
Oh, that they have to be of honest, trustworthy, and high moral character.
Oh.
Okay. So we've got some great buzz terms in the law that the commission has to evaluate to say,
before
does
we give
person
a license,
possess these necessary qualifications.
So we are saying that we agree that these people are honest, trustworthy, and high moral character, and we don't do anything to find out.
Well, I wouldn't say we do. We ask some questions on an application as far as, do they have any convictions and that type of thing. And then they do go out and get reference checks, but as far as the reference checks that have been historically requested, it typically comes from the instructor that taught them at their auctioneering course that fills out the reference check for them, typically for auctioneers. And for clerks, it's going to be somebody that they've had some type of business relationship with.
Okay.
So I'm thinking that an option that we could do, you know, in addition to eliminating the bond hassle for them, and when I say this, my suggestion at this point would be to grandfather in our existing auctioneers, but future new auctioneers to do a North Dakota criminal history record check if they're North Dakotans. We can go through BCI for that, and it's a check for North Dakota criminal backgrounds, so if they did something out of state, it wouldn't necessarily be detected. It takes 7 to 10 business days. It would cost us $15. And then for out-of-state people, and I thought that Jack would still be here during this, and I didn't get to visiting with them beforehand. I'm hoping we can differentiate between the out-of-state new auctioneers as opposed to in-state new auctioneers. That would cost a little more, $18, to have an FBI national check of this. And just see if there's things that would apply to auctioneering that they have a background in that makes us wonder whether they meet that standard that's in the law.
Now, we don't need legislative changes to do that. We could do that with our already, we're supposed to determine if they're in good standing.
Correct. We could commence with background checks and have the requirement there. The issue with the legislative change comes with the $15 fee that's associated with that. For them to be able to pay the fee, we would need a statute change where we could collect that fee to go to BCI with to pay that, if we're going to have the applicant pay that fee.
Well, couldn't we just increase their
That would take a legislative change.
Right. Fees are in legislative
that's
statute,
all set.
So we would need to have that. But certainly we could require that.
We could even have them go procure a background check on their own and then provide it to us. But then it calls into question the integrity of the check,
right?
Because they're providing it to us, not the agency.
Are they? Aren't we already including in our budget increases and the fees for these guys?
No, but I'm going to get to fees, and I'll just do that next, and we can merge this together. The fees for licensing, for licensing and for renewals are the same. They have not been increased for, do you remember, Conrad, like decades also.
I didn't have my little cheat sheet here, but I believe 1997 was the last time the fee was increased. And then the late fee was added just in the early 2000s. 2001, I believe, is when we actually had a late fee that was established for it.
And, of course, that's not money that comes to us. That's a general fund.
Right.
So my intention, until we got into this background discussion, was to just point this out in testimony, both in our budget and here, that you know these license fees haven't been increased for a long time. We're at $35. Many states are over $100. If the legislature wants to increase them, the legislature should do it, not us. But if we're going to instigate the background checks, I think we should be requesting at least the $15 fee, or maybe make it $20 so it would cover both the FBI and the... And then if they want to increase it more for the general fund, they should amend the bill. But
And I think to your point, Commissioner Christman, what we would propose is a new applicant would be responsible for the licensing fee in addition to the background check fee. And then any renewals would be just subject to the licensing fee, which would be the renewal fee, but no background check fee. We would only be conducting background checks on new applicants, not with renewals.
Yeah. So we could address that in the bill without changing the license fee at all. We'd just put in there that there's that we can charge the additional cost of a background check.
Right. The additional cost for a new applicant would be required to pay would be this.
So that's... Was there anything else on the fees now that didn't address?
Mm-mm. I'm just so dumbfounded that we didn't include a proposal in the budget for increasing the fees on the auctioneers and clerks. Because did we just do that on the weights and measures, folks?
As far as I know, it was just the weights and measures. I know that I had not been approached by to talk about what we've actually collected on auctioneer and auction clerk fees.
Well, to that point, though, in our budget, we were. Is Jill still on? I think she is. Maybe she can chime in. Jill, did we specify in the budget where the fee increase? Specifically where they're coming from and how much?
In our discussions with OMB, we have indicated basically what program areas the fees would be generated from. It did not include auctioneers, I think potentially for two reasons. The first being was because there was a discussion about if licensing them was something we wanted to continue to do, and so with that discussion happening, I think we weren't sure if we wanted to continue to do this at all, and if we did, you know, should we make it more robust and beef it up? The other factor in this is compared to the weights and measures, you know, we don't have, say, like auctioneer inspectors. It's just basically a portion of Conrad and Shelley's time. You know, there's not operating necessarily associated with it. It's just people time. And so potentially by raising the fees and putting that in the budget, you know, what's the perception on that is another factor that I can see in that. But... That's a very long-winded explanation, but the bottom line is no, these fees were not included in the budget.
Okay, but are we, based on our budget as it is, are we precluded from saying, adding that or including that in our, because I thought we were kind of general in what we said that to OMB that it would be an increase in fees, but we didn't specify exactly how that would be. So would we still have the flexibility to include this in our, like as we talk to the legislature in our budget presentation?
Yeah, I think we could. I think we could circle back around and talk about, you know, that we've evaluated this other revenue source. In our budget proposal itself, we didn't get overly specific. However, we have been having some follow-up conversations with our budget analyst on where some of the revenue would be coming from.
Okay.
I think because they just need more clarity as far as they can't put all of the self-funding in the budget without fully understanding, you know, what sections of law would need to change. And
sure.
Maybe new sections or updates to current sections and things like that.
Got it.
I think one other factor was if we used it for on our budget specifically, you know, we could double the fees and it would bring in like $15,000.
Yeah.
So.
Right. And I just want to highlight for the commission, too, is that, you know, part of that is, I mean, there is, you know, resources, supplies that are used in this. There's time between IT, Shelley, myself, going through this IT for maintaining the system, other staff that's involved for check receipting when checks get in. So it does cover a larger chunk of the agency as far as time and resources.
Yeah.
Just for something to consider.
I mean, I think it's fairly substantial and should be on the table for consideration.
Then another change, and this is just, I don't know, Conrad and I find it kind of bizarre. Their license period is the calendar year. And so they have to be relicensed by December 31st or January 1st, mm-hmm. whichever it is. However, they don't incur a late fee until February 1st. You know, so.
And that's all in law.
Yeah. It's in statute.
And so they can wait and file sometime in January, and then we're left wondering, well, did you have an unlicensed auction sometime in January or what? So we'd like to move that late fee to December 31st or January 1st, whichever.
The start of this. Since our license expires on December 31st at midnight, and the new one goes effective January 1st at 12:01 a.m., the late fee should be incurred on January. If you renew prior to that, and we give them 2 months to renew a license, and we start getting out their renewal notices beginning in November.
Oh, right.
And so they've got plenty of time to do it, and why there's this additional
gap.
Grace period
yeah.
Just has not sat well with me. And I looked back and legislatively when the late fee was instituted back in the early 2000s, that's how it originally went into effect, was February 1st. So why it was ever put there, I'm not sure what the
yeah.
history on that is. But I just think moving that back would be more an incentive to ensure that individuals get that in. And with the thing that to take note of is potentially looking at the licensing fee increases, the late fee is $25. And that's something where I would recommend to the commission that we look at potentially increasing the late fee as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is depending, you know, in a proportionate amount of how we increase the licenses, because licenses are $35, late fee is $25.
Okay.
And then lastly, and this is a very new thought too, but it's based on a just a casual complaint that I got from a member of the public. And so I've begun looking in. In fact, I think since we're sitting here in this discussion the last couple hours, I got my return call, but I didn't answer it. But there's a question about the salvage titles with automobiles that have been wrecked to a certain level, and then they have a salvage title that indicates that they had major damage at one point. And someone suggested to me that at least up until a certain age of automobile, a car dealer would have to not just send you a salvage title, and a lot of people wouldn't even know that that means anything, but would have to explain to you what that is, and or at least tell you that you're getting a salvage title with this vehicle. And so should we require that of auctioneers as well, to disclose that on, you know, the same level as automobile dealers are required to do it? And so I'm just checking into what the standard is for car dealers. So I just want to throw that out so that everyone else can be contemplating it too, whether that's a requirement we should impose on them.
And I think
Thank you, Brian. Brian's signing off. Okay. Safe travels.
I think that can be done through administrative rules. You know, the commission, our rules and the law is really geared towards the protection of the arrangement between the seller of the items and the auctioneer. And that's what everything's really geared towards. We don't really have anything in place for the, you know, the auctioneer and how they're going to conduct themselves at a sale or the requirements that they're beholden to. And so that's an avenue that I believe, talking with Jack as well, we could do through administrative rulemaking. It's just an area that the commission has never really approached.
Well, is there a whole bunch of other things like that, you know?
I hadn't thought of that. That's probably good. Oh, I'll find out not only how old the car is or whether that's even true, that that's a requirement for car dealers. I'll find out whether it's in the century code or what.
That would be helpful to
it's
know.
An attorney that I'm talking
the,
to.
The issues I've dealt with in the past a little bit have dealt around vehicle titles, whether the auctioneer had, you know, it's in the best interest for the auctioneer to make sure their job is to make as much money for their client as possible. And that's the part of what they're doing at the sale. And advertising a vehicle as having a title is going to generate more money for that vehicle than being non-titled, because some of the process and the lengths you have to go through to get a replacement title, if you can even do it, can be extensive. Same thing with a salvage title. That vehicle is going to be worth less. And so, you know, some of the concern that was brought up is the, you know, kind of the conduct of the auctioneer, their requirement to announce that there's, this is a salvage title, or this is, the vehicle has a title or does not have a title. And there's currently nothing that in our rules that would require that. I'm sure there's probably some other nuance areas we could potentially look at as well. That's the big one that comes to my forefront, the forefront of my mind.
And I'm not anticipating this bringing up this other part, but Conrad hit on the other. Another question is whether they should be required to say whether a vehicle has a title or not. And I just don't know how you draw that line. I mean, you can drag an old piece of steel out of the tree row that was part of a car frame, and if that's where the VIN number was stamped, is that a vehicle, or is that just a piece of scrap iron, or what? I don't know, but there is a... People have made... In fact, this is where the point came to me in the first place, before the salvage title. You know, if you buy an old restored vehicle, but it was a junker in the tree row before, and now you're not getting a title with it, that can be a pretty serious deal. But I don't know where to go to draw clarity.
Well, part of me just feels like if you're buying a car in this way, there are upsides and downsides.
Kind of buyer beware.
I mean, one of the upsides is you might get a really good deal. One of the downsides is you don't know a lot about the background on that car and the risk of, does it have a title or not, or... You should be able to ask the
You have the opportunity
ask.
For a sale
yeah.
to preview items
right.
to make the determination.
And that's up to you. So I just feel like when people are shopping at auctions, they need to there's risks there. Right. And they need to – we can't protect them from all those yeah. risks. And going down that path, I feel like is a little bit dangerous, because then, you know, there's probably other products that have different things that should be disclosed and should we be requiring it. And I think it makes me nervous, especially because I'm coming from the standpoint of, let's research the states that don't have licensing requirements, and who are they and why don't they have them, and how are people protected there, and let's go in that direction, not let's take on more responsibility here to protect, try to, with the very limited and dwindling resources that we seem to be getting, do more. I mean, it just seems like it takes quite a lot of time for you guys to do all this licensing. And it's a lot of paperwork shuffling.
And this isn't to say that auctioneers are completely, you know, kind of able to do what they choose to do. I mean, they're still upholding to the Uniform Commercial Code. requirements. You know, they've got to do their sales tax items. There's a lot of additional areas of set of law that they have to follow that aren't necessarily under the purview of the commission.
Right.
So.
Right, but yet people will come to us for potential enforcement action or anything else on all those other things. Right. As we've seen in the other areas where we have a little bit of jurisdiction but not that much, say, for instance, railroads, and people think we should be able to enforce all the laws that the railroads are beholden to, and we just simply don't have, A, that authority, or B, those kind of resources.
And it brings
maybe that's a good reason to just stay out of the damaged title discussion, too. But.
Right, and that you know, grieved individual always has the option to choose their own legal course as well. And then they can hire an attorney to go do their research and find out what exactly other laws might have been.
Yeah.
And I know that the question of the commission's authority really came up in with the pandemic, as far as when, you know, public people were wanting to hold public auctions.
Right.
And they wanted to come to the commission to say, well, you need to shut these down. Working with Jack, the commission doesn't have the authority to say you can't have that public auction. The only thing, the best we could have done was revoke an auctioneer's license. Which we'd have, there has to be, you know, a basis of fact and an opportunity for hearing before that can happen. So,
yeah, we saw this also with the meat lockers recently, where, you know, there's a complaint against the meat locker and various things, and there's probably a legitimate case there, but we don't have the authority to enforce any sort of action. But because of the way, you know, it was a scale issue, we get kind of pulled in, and then people are disappointed because they feel like they're not very protected. It's like, well, so I don't know. I'm not opposed to these things necessarily, Randy, but I do have some significant concerns about getting more involved in this area versus looking at, or I guess maybe at the same time would be good to evaluate the avenues that would exist to have us not do licensing anymore of auctioneers.
I don't think that's a good idea. I dislike that idea, but
yeah.
All these other things are certainly on the table.
I think you hit on something at the very beginning that is true as long as we are doing licensing, and that is when they see that they're licensed by the Public Service Commission, people think they're protected. And that's... And then we're subject to, well, what are you doing? What's behind all your licensing requirements? You know, and it's never going to be enough if you're aggrieved. It's not.
It's really a shame, though, for some people who, or it could be, you know, potentially really a shame for some people who maybe aren't real savvy and they sell their household out or something like that and end up getting somebody who passes themselves off as being able to auction, and maybe they can talk fast. And so they're perceived that way, but they haven't had the kind of training that you get at an auction school. They don't advertise well. They don't collect sales tax, and all of a sudden someone is victimized or don't come through with the money as they're supposed to. There's a lot of things that someone who doesn't have any training could do to really mess up somebody's sale, too. But
they could do that today.
Well, they'd be operated as an unlicensed auctioneer. They'd at least face some consequences. Now it's just the same thing as your friend helps you move and damages your furniture. There's not much you can really do about it.
Well, and I bet there's a difference. I bet there's some levels in between that and what we're doing in the states that don't do what we're doing. You know, there's probably some standards that exist for auctioneers that protect the public, but I don't know. I haven't looked into it, so.
It also, I think, you know, protects the purchasers at the auction sale too, who didn't have it chance to necessarily review the qualifications of the auctioneer. The seller at least chose that auctioneer or someone who wasn't an auctioneer if we don't license. The buyer doesn't really get that chance to review. Now you go out and buy something of more significant value and they fail to collect sales tax and you think that's the total price and find out later that Ryan is knocking on your door wanting the sales tax on that, and then there's all those problems.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is important. I'm glad North Dakota requires licensure of auctioneers. I just think we can make the program better.
Do you... like the FBI checks, I think that's probably smart and we should just start doing those. It's because they're not that much money and it's an extra layer of evaluation that we probably, it suggests that we're doing some of that. What is it? Good standing, not good standing.
Oh, the good honesty, ethical, and high moral character.
High moral character. The eliminating of the bond on the auctioneers versus, I'm open to you exploring that. I'll just say that I am skittish with these changes, especially if we have to come forward and initiate them, especially as it relates to eliminating a bond. Because what's driving the change? We proactively trying to, do we see shortcomings and wanting to fix them? Have we had problems that are driving it? And if there isn't a problem driving it, then we don't have much of a defense if something goes wrong in the other direction and we just decided to do this all of a sudden. And so I'd be more inclined to just keep the bond for the auctioneers and elevate the bond for the clerks versus eliminating that without anything driving us in that direction, just because, I don't know, we've seen how bad things can go with people who are harmed, and then we've taken away a protection that, I agree with you, it suggests there's a protection, but so does a license. Suggests that we're doing something there.
Yeah. I think the bond elevates it some, but...
But then it also does provide a little bit of protection, too. I mean, it is 10 grand.
It's five.
Five for the auctioneers.
Oh, five. Five and 10. Yeah, I see.
Ultimately, I mean, the option could be there to leave the auctioneer bond as is or potentially increase that proportionally with the auction clerk bond as well. I mean, I'd be interested to hear what your friend has to say. If he said there's like you explained it to me, if there's a minimum bonding fee that basically will get you a bond that runs from $100 up to, you know, $25,000, that it doesn't actually cost them any more. They
right.
just have to get that. Well, then let's cap that out, whatever that minimum threshold is.
My friend said that he doesn't think that below about $20,000 or $30,000 that it would make any difference. What
yeah.
amount is.
So it's not any more
not
additional
write
money.
Them for any less than a certain amount.
Right. So it's not any additional money out of their pockets if we just kind of put that in there and recognize it's not going to cause a change to them. And then there's that additional revenue there.
So we'll keep working on this, but now at least you're kind of aware of what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With new ideas.
I wish there was a different agency or a licensing body or somebody who could take this over as the...
There are. They just wouldn't be as good at it as we are.
Okay. There's potentially...
How do we know that?
What would happen like with other licensing agencies is you've got the electrician's board, you have the plumber's board. It would be an establishment of a board by the legislature to have an auctioneer's board.
So it's sort of self-policing, which I do like just from a philosophical standpoint, because then the industry is holding themselves accountable to the public.
Right.
And there's direct accountability there from them versus hiding, you know, then we're responsible for being the enforcers of and the writers of wrongs when we have so few tools to do it, you know, and
doesn't the Secretary of State also do some licensing? I know they do contractors.
I'm not too familiar with that. I'm sure they do, but I'm not sure.
Well, you have to register with them. I don't know if they license, though. They might.
They are called licenses, I believe, but...
Yeah.
I don't know that there's any standard for it other than until there's complaints coming in about them.
Yeah, or if there's insurance required or...
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think there is insurance requirements because that, either insurance or bonding, because that can lead to that license being revoked.
Sometimes when you hear a contract, you hear, oh, I'm licensed and bonded. So,
yeah.
I'm not familiar with, I haven't looked into that before.
All right, well, I think it's good that you've dug up all these options, and we'll stay tuned for further proposals.
We'll keep plugging along.
Good. Thanks, Jill. And anybody else who's still out there. I guess we have completed our legislative discussion. Meeting is adjourned.